Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Welcome to the Parenting Aces radio show on Blog Talk Radio's UR Tennis Network. I'm your host, Lisa Stone, and we've got another fab show today with guest Larry Lauer. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Larry in just a minute, but I wanted to just kind of give those of you who have been listening to the show for a while a reminder. Larry was actually on the show back in November of 2012, and if you want to go back and listen to that show, if you go to parentingaces.com/radio show, you'll see the link to that podcast and Larry's work and researching coaches and mental training and mental skills for kids. It was a terrific show. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to it, I hope you'll check back and take a listen. But today, Larry is here as the mental skills specialist for USTA player development. And the reason that I'm having him back on the show, besides the obvious that all of us parents and I'm guessing our kids could use some help in the mental skills arena. But Larry was one of the panelists for the recent HBO documentary Trophy Kids. And you guys that read the blog, y'all know I wrote about that show when it first aired, and I have encouraged all of you to look it up on HBO's website or HBO Go if you have access to that. The show profiled four different athletes, well, five athletes, ones that were twins, and their parents. And it was a very interesting look at what's happening in youth sports and the challenges that we parents face and the pressures that our kids face. And Larry led a really informative roundtable discussion at the end of the documentary. And so I, being me, reached out to him immediately and asked him if he would mind coming back on the show to discuss that and some other issues as well. So without further ado, let me bring him on the air. Larry, I'm so happy to have you back. Are you there with us?
I'm here, Lisa. Yeah, thanks for having me back on. This is always a good time. So,
well, good. I'm really looking forward to today's chat. As I mentioned to you when I first contacted you after Trophy Kids aired, that show just stuck with me. It really had a big impact on me and made me take a hard look at how I parent my athlete and mistakes that I've made and how I can rectify those and hopefully not leave too many deep-seated scars in my kid as he moves into adulthood. I mm-hmm. think all of us as parents fear what's going to come out on the couch when our kids go back into the therapist's office as adults and tell the stories on us. But I'm really anxious to kind of dig a little deeper into the challenges that we parents face with our young athletes and, you know, the long-standing impact we can have on them, and also to talk more about how USTA is working to help educate parents so that we do a better job for our kids. And, you know, I was thrilled to learn that you had been hired by them. I don't think they could have made a better choice. So I know you're enjoying the warm weather down in Florida, and I'm just blowing a big old raspberry to you as we're awaiting another winter storm in Atlanta. But So, I mean, let's jump right in. I have a caller on the line. I don't know if they've just called in to listen. I'll check in with you in just a second, but I do want to jump in with Larry. Tell us, first of all, exactly what your job entails with USTA so parents can understand what you're doing there.
Okay, yes. I was hired for a new position. It was just created last year, started in May, but as a mental skills specialist for player development. And just so most people probably know, but player development as a arm of the USTA, our job is to develop our players and to prepare them for, you know, playing at an elite level, whether it's junior level tennis, college tennis, or playing in pros. And so a part of the mission that they wanted, the services they wanted to provide to their players, was mental skills, sports psychology, mental toughness, however you want to label that, and to bring that to the kinds of resources we provide our training pros and elite juniors. So I was brought on board to really focus, obviously, on the mental skills and the mental game. And in my role, I work directly with our players, pros and juniors. I work with our coaches on a daily basis, talking about what's going on with our players, how we can help them from the mental side. And then as well as I work with our the rest of our staff around here to create resources, educational materials, presentations, go out and do presentations for different groups. And I also work closely with our player ID and development department, working through our regional training centers and getting the message out to younger players and their coaches around the country, and trying to be very inclusive of America's coaches, tennis coaches, and really make sure that we're providing them the resources and information they need to be successful. So my job is sort of, there's a number of things that I do, but certainly the priority is direct service to our players and coaches and making sure they have the information, the skills, the strategies they need from the mental side to be successful.
Great. And, we all know, we parents all know, we've seen our kids mentally break down on the court. Mm-hmm. And if any of you listening have never seen your child mentally break down on the court, just count yourself lucky, because yeah. I think it's one of the hardest things to watch, honestly, as a parent. I've experienced it more times than I can count, and really, it's interesting as these kids get older and develop further along in their tennis. A lot of it comes down to simply who's mentally tougher on the court. I mean, they all hit the ball well, they all move well, they're all at a relatively high fitness level, and a lot of the times it really does come down to the mental skills and. Especially dealing with those in the teenage years, they're not always so willing to fess up that they need help in that arena. So yeah. I'm hoping that maybe you can share some tips with all of us, especially those of us with teenagers, as to how we can kind of introduce the idea of mental skills training mm-hmm. with our kids and how best to find resources for that information.
Sure, happy to, Lisa. I think, one is that parents want to understand that all players are going to struggle at times mentally as well as physically and different ways. But as you move up and your child becomes more of an elite player, you start to reduce the variability in performance between those athletes. Something has to make the difference, right? And when the games are pretty close, when the fitness is close, often it's the mind that changes the course and direction of the match, and that makes all the difference. And what I tell our players all the time is, when you hit a forehand, where did that start? It didn't start in your shoulder. It started in your brain. And if your brain isn't working effectively, if it's not communicating messages in an effective way, your game is going to suffer. So I think, however we can try to reach young people, I agree that for adolescents it can be difficult to own up to, there's things that I need to work on. But I have a couple recommendations for parents on that. First is always, always treat this as enhancing your game. If we talk about players as having head cases, mental problems, they need to be fixed, and I hear parents say that sometimes, they don't mean anything bad by it. It's just the language that they're using, but it tells the kid that there's something wrong with me, and then they get the wrong sort of impression of what we're trying to do in terms of mental skills training or sports psychology. So we're always going to come from the perspective that we're enhancing someone, helping them become better. And if you look at all the great players in the world, their mental games are very strong. They have to be. So you want to begin developing that as well. So I think using examples of pros who have very strong mental games, or even pros who finally ask for help, you know, like Andy Murray, who would get frustrated, negative on the court. Obviously, hiring Lendl made a big difference, but he also worked with a sports psychologist, and they talked about it in the news, and really how he was able to kind of get himself under control and focused and really managing his emotions well. And obviously, that was one of the factors that helped him take a step towards winning the Olympics and then U.S. Open and finally Wimbledon, which to me would have been one of the most nerve-wracking experiences ever to be in that situation. But with the country just, you know, crying for a winner, you know, all that 77-year wait and everything. But so I think we want to explain to our kids that it's about helping you become better. It's not about fixing the problem. So one suggestion along with that is don't wait until your kid loses after being up 5-1. Because to the kid, they'll make the connection of, okay, there's something wrong with me. I'm a choker. Do it in a situation where there isn't a stimulus to make the kid feel like, oh, there's something wrong with me. Now, you can't always work that way, but the more you can think of it developmentally, that your mind needs to be strong, it needs to be functioning well to be an athlete, but also to be a healthy young person. And if we do this, and this is part of what we do, then I think it can be very effective, and kids can open up to it. Another suggestion is if a parent's thinking about it, throw it out to your coach at your local club, and maybe they can bring someone in who can talk to a group of kids. It'll reduce the cost per parent, but also it makes it a little more easy to open the door to sports psychology and get the kids, okay, this isn't directed at me. This is all of us in this together. And at least they can get a sense, and hopefully the person who's delivering the information is good and can get the kids engaged. That's a way to sort of take the spotlight off of the kid and let them kind of feel, you know, it's not just me, I'm not the only one in this. And then also explain that many, many, many athletes work with sports psychologists, and if they don't, they're still working on their mental game with their coach.
Right.
Coaches are amateur sports psychologists through and through. And, you know, so you're working on it anyway. It's just trying to bring, you know, more systematic training to it. And finally, if you have a good coach that understands the mental game, and, you know, let them work on that. Let them talk to the kid about it, bring it in, because when it's integrated in that way, oftentimes it's not seen as, oh, I've got to go lay on the couch, or I got to do my brain work now. It becomes, hey, look, this is a part about competing in tennis. And, you know, when the coach is often talking about it, it will open the door later to either the coach doing more or bringing in an outside expert to help.
And if there are any coaches listening, I really, really, really hope you take Larry's suggestion seriously about bringing in help and using it in a group situation, because I know, especially again with the older kids, they don't want to be singled out necessarily. And I think your suggestion, Larry, that doing it in that group setting is really valuable. And I know for my kid, I think it would, you know, he would respond much better in a group setting than he would individually. And the kids, I mean, let's face it, they do look at, you know, talking to a sports psychologist as, you know, what's wrong with me? My parents think I'm nuts. They think I'm a choker. They think I can't handle pressure, whatever, whatever. And so if we can send a message that this isn't about, like you said, fixing something, but rather it's part of a complete training that you need to reach that next level. I think that's really, really helpful. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. Can I just make one more comment, Lisa?
Yeah, please.
And just tying it to what we're doing here at the USCA is then talking to all of our regional coaches about these kinds of things and delivering the message so that it's not just, it just doesn't live here in Boca, but we go out and we talk to all these coaches, and we had a bunch here in Boca this weekend about, you know, let's focus on developing kids and helping them to feel like this is part of what we do versus you have to have a problem to work on this. So, you know, through you know, the training centers and whatnot, trying to get that message out. And there's a number of different ways that I can get into in a little bit. So.
Awesome. We have a couple callers on the line, so let me just check in with them and see if they have a question. Our first one is a caller from area code 269. Are you there? Caller
just
from 269?
Just listening.
Just listening. Okay, thank you. Keep on. And we have also a caller from area code 469-955. Are you on?
I am, Lisa. How are you today?
I'm good. Who's on the line with us?
Good. Dewey Evans.
Oh, hey, Dewey.
Hey. Couple questions for your guest, and I'm going to take his answers offline. But what are his thoughts on rituals is one. And the other is, are any of these talks that he gives to the regional training centers, have they been taped and are they available, like, on the USTA Dartfish TV channel or anything like that?
Great questions, Dewey. Thank you. Larry, I'm turning it to you.
Okay. Thanks, Sue, for those questions. You know, first, we do make some presentations available when we can videotape. We actually did a parent presentation at TBRM in Austin, Texas, or excuse me, Dallas, Texas, in November, and we put that on USDA.tv. So that's out there. So if you search my last name, Lauer, or search parents, you're going to find that. We're also in the course of, you know, creating more parent educational materials. We haven't gotten it all together yet, but we are working on that. And finally, and, you know, I'm also creating resources from just the mental skills and performance enhancement side. And we've been sending stuff out to our regional training centers, these online presentations, you know, that I'm doing, for example, on, you know, setting goals or on how to prepare for matches or routines, as Dewey brought up. So those are I'm in the process of developing them. I've created five, and they've, like I said, they've gone out to our regional training centers. We're going to figure out how best to make those available to folks. But, yes, we're in the process of creating more and more resources, and you will continue to see those coming out. So we'll do our best to make sure people hear about them. The first question about routines and rituals, to me, the way that you integrate mental skills into the actual match and into the competition is through routines. When you're in pressure situations, you need to have a plan. Plans are huge. And sometimes in the worst situations, even a bad plan is better than no plan. And so having a plan gives you something to go to. So it's like when a basketball player has a free throw shooting routine and they're all this pressure and they're by themselves at the line, if they can go to their plan, they start to get to a comfort level. They start to get to some simple performance cues that allow them just to stop thinking and start doing, which is really what we want in the moment. So routines are going to be absolutely crucial for our developing players to learn and begin to integrate into their performances. And again, like I said, if you're teaching kids things like visualization, relaxation, cognitive strategies, or, you know, how to manage their self-talk or their emotions, you want to put those into routines that they can do before matches, between points, and also during changeovers. Because the biggest issue that we have with sports psychology, one of the biggest issues, is the issue of transfer. So I teach someone how to do deep breathing off the court, how is that going to look during the match, and how is that going to help them? And so we have to bring that into a routine that's relevant and that can be effective in that 20-some-odd second time period that they have between points. So to answer the question, simply, routines are very important in everything we do. Every player that I work with, we get to routines, whether it's creating routines for all for a bunch of different situations or literally just creating one routine that they use for specific triggers that upset them, things that set them off, like making mistakes. So routines are going to be should be a fundamental part of any you know serious tennis player's match game plan, I would say.
Great. Dewey, I hope that answers your questions.
It did. I had some experience with young people that fall into some of the patterns that he talks about and finding ways to come out of the patterns. I heard him say earlier, you know, don't wait until you see your kid, you know, losing a match that he was up 5-1 where he's going to, you know, think there's something wrong with him and he's choking. You know, how can we create for our players more recent memory or memories that they draw upon rather than the one which says, oh, I just, you know, I'm choking again. And the more I try to not think about choking, the more I'm actually now fixated on choking. You know, what kind of strategy do you help with?
Sure. And it works the same for the zone. We always say, if you're in the zone, don't think about it. Because once you start thinking about it, you're out of the zone. You know, you're right. And that can get stuck in people's mind and begin to dwell on that. Now you've created a slump out of nowhere. To me, athletes who have strong mental games are able to control the thoughts and the images that are in their mind. And so even when something bad happens to them, like they lose, after, you know, they lose when they have match points or they lose a match they feel they should win or a final or whatever it is, you got to be able to learn from it and you have to let go. And that's the starting of sort of bouncing back from a big loss like that is, you know, feeling it, you're going to be upset, that's fine. By the end of the day, make sure you've learned from it. What are the lessons you learned from this match? What would you do differently next time? I often tell the players to make two lists of things you did well because you always want to recognize what you did well and then the things you didn't do well. At the end of the day, take that list of things you didn't do well, tear it apart, throw it in the garbage, and focus on what you want to do tomorrow about it. Start thinking forward. It's the idea of failing forward. And so from there, a good dose of either using video of past matches where you played well and or visualizing matches where you played well can be very key in helping a tennis player get over a big loss. And then I think it's also important to get back on the court and begin to compete again, practice sets, practice matches. You know, it's not the same as a tournament match, but it's amazing how much, you know, playing well in a practice set or a practice match can help to erase some of those thoughts. Is that a cure-all? No. At some point, when you've lost and you've been up 5-1 in a set, if that's happened to you, you get in that situation again, that thought will likely come back up. But if you've trained yourself and have a plan that, okay, if this comes up, take a couple deep breaths, let go, visualize what you're going to do in this next point. I'm going to kick it out wide. I'm going to set up my forehand. The more you train that in practice sets off the court as well as on the court, then you can be prepared to handle that situation well when it comes back up.
That's a great answer.
Thank you.
Dewey, thanks so much for
You're
calling
welcome.
In. I hope you'll listen to the rest of the show.
I'm certainly going to sit here and try.
Okay, Larry. So that's all just fantastic advice. And so now I have a follow-up question for you, which I feel like I ask this question all the time of my guests. But you know, I parent a kind of a stubborn 17-year-old who knows that his mom knows some stuff, but really doesn't want to hear what his mom knows. and takes information much better from his coach than he does from his mom. So as a mom, it can be very frustrating to be in that situation because I'll see things come up in his matches or just out off the court that I feel like I have some information that would be helpful, but I'm hesitant to share it because I don't want him mm-hmm. to shut it down. Any tips for that kind of situation? I don't think I'm alone in this, just from talking to other parents at tournaments. Okay, good.
And let me just tell you, sports psychologists go through the same thing with their kids, so they're not immune to, all their kids listen to them. No, I think it's sort of a part of the human condition that your children are more likely to listen to other people as they get older. So we have to expect that and realize it's just sort of the way of things. To me, as a parent, if you're seeing something and you feel like it could be helpful, best thing to do is to tell the coach away from the child. Talk to the coach about, hey, this is what I saw. I'm not sure how helpful it is to you, but I wanted to give you this, kind of from sitting outside and watching the matches, what I picked up. Most of the coaches I know are supportive of that, and they want to, get information from parents. And to be honest, a lot of times the coaches don't travel with the kids and can't see them play. And so if the parent can give the coaches some information on what they saw, that can help that coach in developing the next practices. So I always say, feed it back into your coach, especially as they become 17. As parents, we tend to drop into the background a little bit more and become emotional support, encouragement, certainly advice about important decisions and trying to help them make good decisions. But, it's natural, and we do want them to really lean on their coach for these kinds of things because that's why, they're there. The coach is the expert. The coach is the one who's hopefully been through this many times and knows how to help that person. So I think the parent, if they see themselves more as a support role, and then if they do have information that can be helpful, feed it to the coach. Let the coach give that feedback to the player in a way then that the player will listen. Because if the person won't listen, to be honest, you're doing more harm than good then, right, Lisa? I mean,
right.
Because
sure.
Now they're frustrated at you, and they're not going to listen to the next thing you say versus, working through the coach. And now what I will say, one nuance to this for parents is that, in our research sort of, the tennis parent research we did the last decade has borne this out, but when it comes to things like sportsmanship and attitude, I still believe the parent should be leading the charge. So parents should feel free, and I think it's their right and their responsibility, that if their child is being unsportsmanlike, if they're doing behaviors that you do not like to see in your child, that have nothing to do with performance, even though they might affect the performance, then the parents should step up and give that feedback right away. I see that as the parent's role always, versus performance-related things really work to your coach.
Right, and I mean, that's a really important distinction, too, and thank you for bringing that up, because that's, it's also something you struggle with as a parent, and especially as kids get older, sometimes you feel like you've lost your window of opportunity if you didn't take care of those issues early on, and I know my husband and I have had that conversation before. My son has made tremendous progress in regard to his on-court behavior, and I'm really proud of that, but, a lot of it probably could have been handled when he was 9, 10, 11 years old and avoided the stress and strain of, dealing with suspension points and code violations and all of that when it really started to matter in the 16s and 18s. But anyway, let's switch gears a bit, and I know I could talk this whole hour to you about mental training and what to do, but I really do want to go back to the Trophy Kids documentary, and even though it's been several weeks since I saw it, I still think about it all the time. And so it's just, I'm going to just be really selfish because I'm the host and I can be. I want to hear more from you on the aftermath of airing Trophy Kids, whether you've had contact with the families that were in the film and, you know, any information that you've gleaned either from them directly or from the kids or from viewers that have contacted you, you know, and what we can all learn from those parents who really put themselves out there for, I mean, I feel like they did me such a favor by allowing themselves to be documented on camera so that I could reflect and learn.
Yeah, no, it's been an interesting, I think there was an immediate sort of Twitter, social media response where a lot of people were saying how disgusting this is or how bad they feel for the children. There were some other not-so-kind comments coming across. You know, I got a lot of feedback that they thought that the show, the information was helpful, that it was much needed. I did not have any contact with the folks that were documented in the show. Not necessarily what I was looking to do. I think I'm sure it was hard for them to watch that and then to hear us talk about some of the things that they were doing wrong. Not to say I felt like it was my responsibility to say certain things and not hold back. But at the same time, it would be really hard for a parent to hear that on a show, on a channel like HBO. I think in the aftermath, one of the things in talking with Peter Berg and his group was, let's not just do the show, but then provide some resources on HBO Go. So what they did was they create a page off of the show page, the link where the show is, and for HBO on their website, HBO Go, with some parent resources, some educational materials. So we tried to at least, you know, parents are coming watching that, say, hey, look, you know, the show was great. There's a lot more information out there to help you. Here are some at least some resources to get you started. In the aftermath of that, I would say, you know, your sort of what you talked about, Lisa, when you wrote about the show, some other people, I still feel like it was, I think there's certain people who have been highly affected by it, but I still question how many people that's changed. And I think it's always important for me to remember that the work is never over. That we, you know, need to go back out and do the next show, or more importantly, create the next materials or talk to the next parent and help them, you know, understand what they need to do. So I think it brought a lot of great awareness. It shocked people. It got them thinking about themselves, reflecting on their own behaviors and attitudes. And, you know, that's great. I think that's certainly, you know, Peter Berg, the panelist, the host, wanted to at least open the conversation and get people's attention, and I think he did that well.
Yeah, I agree. And it's interesting, just before we went on air today, I had gotten a link to another show called Friday Night Tykes, and it's about youth football, and the clip that I watched was with third graders, so 8 and 9 year olds maybe, playing full contact football, and it was profiling some coaches and some parents, and you know, it was more of the same, that the same stuff that we saw in Trophy Kids. And so obviously this is an epidemic across a lot of youth sports. I won't say all, because I'm not familiar with all of them, but we're certainly hearing more and more stories of borderline abusive coaches, borderline abusive parents, and you know, to what end? I mean, what are we doing to our kids, and what's the reason that we as parents put our kids in organized sports to begin with? What are we hoping to accomplish by putting them in sports, and are we doing that? Are we accomplishing that, or are we undermining those efforts? And what can we do better? And it's funny because I feel like I say the same thing over and over again when I write about these issues or when I have guests on like yourself to talk about these issues. But, I mean, for our family, tennis was never about making millions of dollars or getting a full ride to college. It's always been about a balance between becoming proficient at a skill and learning life lessons that will serve our kids well in whatever they pursue in their adult lives. And I just feel like, you know, I don't know if it's the media, I don't know if it's the massive salaries of top athletes, but something is driving this kind of disgusting aspect of youth sports. And I'm curious, you know, from your perspective, from the scientist's perspective, what can we do to turn the tide here?
Yeah, we've been talking about, so myself and some of my colleagues, like Dan Gould at Michigan State, about this for some time. And, you know, it's difficult to parse out all the different things that are going on. Certainly, the media and the glorifying of the athlete, which, hey, great, you know, it's great for the athletes and the attention, but at the same time, you know, what are some of the messages that we're sending across, that it's about ourselves versus anyone else, or, you know, this is the ultimate, to be on TV versus being a good person or whatever. I think there's certain messages that get sold that maybe even the media, either they don't own up to or they don't understand. I think also there's a lot of entrepreneurs and business people who have made a killing off of sport, especially children. And it's, I equate it to when you have a child, they have all these products that they get you to buy because you're afraid that you're going to screw up your child. They're not going to learn how to read. They're not going to learn how to walk. And so you have to have these songs. You got to have these videos. You got to have this toy, or you're not doing what you should as a parent. And I think a lot of times our children show an interest in sport, and there's enough of these people out there who say, hey, what a great opportunity for me to make some money. I can sell this and put that fear in a parent's mind. Look, if you're not doing this, you're not doing everything you can for your child. And so I think that's a part of it. I think there's a lot of ego involved for coaches and for parents. You know, for sure, as a parent, you want your child to be successful. And, you know, you want to do everything you can for them. And at the same time, there are certain lessons they need to learn that we can't get in the way of, and we need to allow to happen. So I think sometimes, you know, at the start, most parents, from our research, from what we know, parents start for the right reasons, to get their kids moving, to get them involved, to meet other kids, to learn a skill, to have fun. That goal changes over time, unintentionally a lot of times, where it becomes about getting a scholarship, being better than the kid down the street, making a certain select team, getting into certain tournaments. It becomes mm-hmm. about status. It becomes about ego. I think that happens a lot of times unintentionally. And I think what we try to do, almost every time I talk to parents, one of the first questions I ask them is the why question. Why do you play? Why do you allow your child to play tennis? What's their reasons? What are your reasons? And really trying to get at the core of, hey, you know, has that changed? And is it different from your child? And if it has changed and it's different from your child's, you need to go back and do some thinking about why you're doing this again, and maybe need to take a little pause and figure this out. I think that's often what happens, is we get sucked into this world of trying to be better than someone else. You want your kid to be successful, and we start equating it to our own self-worth. We feel good about ourselves as a parent if our child's successful. And when they fail in sport, we feel like we failed. And so, you know, we get that emotionally attached, that involved, that you start doing things to reach an end that really isn't what you started out for, if that makes sense. And then the child becomes really becomes objectified to be a means to an end. The end is no longer for the child to have a good experience. The end becomes reaching this outcome goal, and now the child is the vehicle to get there. They're the object. And when you start going down that road, you start taking risks you normally wouldn't take with a child. Too much training. We saw in the Trophy Kids show the basketball dad who had his kid on like 40 different pills when he was a youngster. I mean, he's taking these risks and things that you would never do if you had the perspective of, hey, first, let's develop a healthy child, and then, let's see if we can develop an excellent athlete. So I think that gets skewed by that goal, and when the parent takes on the goal, it becomes their goal, then you got a real problem. And the little girls who played golf, her dad talked about, and this was completely opposite to everything we teach, that once you get the kid buy into your goal, then you got them. I hope the listeners heard that and got disgusted because, well, I think in the long run, he'll probably regret saying that. That is the complete opposite to what we know about fulfillment, about motivation, about everything that allows people to reach their human potential. So, it is what it is. Parents, where are they getting their information? And I think sometimes, to be honest, they're not getting enough good information. They're just really kind of making it up and hoping that they get it right.
Yeah. It's interesting that you brought up the golfer because that dad, I think I told you, he called me after I wrote my article. I don't know where he saw it, but we had a long phone conversation, and you could tell he was mortified by what he saw on television.
Mm-hmm.
He absolutely mortified and, made a point. Well, first of all, started out by asking me what my opinion of him was after seeing the show, which was a really, took me aback. I was like,
awkward.
Well, do you want me to be perfectly honest with you? And he said, yeah, I want you to be honest. And I gave him an honest assessment. I said, my heart was hurting for your daughter. I couldn't believe how awful you were being to her. And that actually spurred a really heartfelt conversation on his end.
That's good.
About what he learned by seeing himself on film like that and the changes that he's been able to make and the things he's working on to improve. But, I can't imagine that there are very many parents out there who, when their kid wins, whether it's an individual sport like tennis or it's a team sport, doesn't feel elated by that win. And when their kid loses, doesn't feel, let down, not necessarily by the kid, but just, a loss just doesn't feel as good as a win. And, it's hard to, as the parent, set that aside and not get caught up. And like you said, all the quote entrepreneurs that are out there trying to sell us something to make us feel inadequate if we don't buy it. And I think you so hit the nail on the head with that because I just looking back at some of the people that have approached me about, coming on the show or having me write about information that they'd like to get out to the public. I'm approached a lot with products and services that, somebody like you, being educated and having been around this for as long as you have, would say that is so not necessary. Do not spend the money there. Do not stress yourself out over that. But as a parent, you see it and you think, oh my gosh, this is the next thing. If I don't do this for my kid, he's going to be behind the eight ball. And, it's a lot of pressure. And I think that, for USTA to continue to make the effort to provide education to us and not just through the training centers and not just at the elite events, but honestly, where USTA needs to reach us is at the low level, local events, where families are just getting started with all of this. Nip it in the bud, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Give us the information from the get-go so that we don't have to backtrack and undo bad behavior, but can rather get on the path with the right behavior from the beginning.
I agree with you, Lisa, on it. It's certainly a step that, you know, we got to find how best to do that. You know, working locally. You know, one of the things, and I know it's not at the lowest level, but, you know, doing presentations at zonals over, I did many of those in the Midwest, talking to parents about behaviors and attitudes. So I think that's another place that we've, you know, over the last 10 years have tried to educate. You know, putting things on websites are one thing, but getting the message out at whatever level we can. So we're always talking around here how better can we do the job, and certainly trying to get that message out to more people is one of the things that I'll be focused on. The always the hard part is how can you get it to people where they'll hear it and it will make a difference, and so creatively, you know, putting resources to that is what we've got to do. I would say, you know, going back to what you were saying earlier, Lisa, that there's a lot of people who are living unintentionally, whether the athlete, the coach, or the parent. And you have to have, as a parent, as an adult, the ability to check yourself in the moment. You have to, instead of responding, be able to say, hey, you know what? Boy, I'd really like to see my daughter do well here. Okay, just relax. It's just another match. You have to have the ability to check yourself in the moment, because when the emotional mind takes over, you start reacting in ways that you can't take back. And that's when we yell at our kids, when we yell at other families, when we yell at the officials, when we criticize our kids. You have to be able to filter those things, to be able to check yourself. And I always say, look, I tell the parents, a simple way to remember is the STAR method. If you're feeling it, you're feeling pressure, you're feeling a lot of emotion, you're feeling sort of this urge to say something and it's not within the zone that you're completely confident that it's going to come across the right way, go to the STAR method. Stop, think, act, and reflect on it. You know, stop yourself, take a breath, think about, okay, what did I want to say? What's really going on here? Think about the different options you have. Saying nothing, saying it this way, saying it that way, and then choose, and then go ahead and, you know, reflect later on how it went. But I think just going through that process, your emotions start to come down, you start to think more rationally, you can make much better decisions about how you're communicating, interacting with your child. So to me, while I understand and I appreciate the fact parents are under pressure, they're also adults, and they got to step up and do the right things. I put it on myself, I put it on you, I put it on everybody, right? Because we have the most important job in the world, that's being a parent, and we have to step up.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, your kids are still young, and, mm-hmm. you know, you're, you know, educated on this and are, I'm sure, you know, working daily to make sure you do your best job as the rest of us are as well. Well, I mean, no, I'm serious, but... But, I mean, it's interesting. We were at a tournament this weekend out of town, and my son's last match, it was at night, and it was freezing, and luckily he was on a court that I could sit in my car and watch. And my son teases me because I watch a lot of tennis on TV, and I yell at the TV a lot when the matches are going on. Not yell nasty, but I have a running commentary pretty much, and he always teases me, you know, Mom, you know they can't hear you. You know they're not paying attention to what you're saying, yada, yada. And so after his match, which he lost, and he knew exactly why he had lost the match, later, I guess the next day, we were talking about it, and I said, yeah, I was really glad I was in my car with the windows rolled up so you couldn't hear me. And he said, you talk to me when I'm playing like you talk to the TV? And I said, well, I don't talk to you if I'm sitting courtside, but if I'm in my car with the windows rolled up, yes, I am talking. And he was shocked to hear that. But, you know, for me, it's very therapeutic. I would never, some of the stuff I say in my car with the windows rolled up, I would never in a million years want to say out loud where anybody could hear me. But it is very cathartic to be able to let it out in the moment so that by the time he does get off the court, it's all out of me. I'm done. You know, I can, I can, like you said, take the emotion out and just say, like Wayne Bryan suggests, you know, are we going for burgers or pizza? Do you want water or Gatorade? I'm well equipped to do that by, you know, kind of letting it all out in the car, but we don't always get that opportunity. All right, we have another caller on the line. Let me see. Area code 610, do you have a question?
Yes, my name's Greg Scott. I'm very friendly with Larry.
And, hey, Greg.
How you doing?
Yeah.
Good. We used to work together a little bit. I'm on the hockey side of things, and one of the things that you're talking about with parents that I find, I've also been a hockey coach. I'm a tennis player, lifelong tennis player, as Larry knows, and I'm also a hockey coach for over 30 years, and one of the things that I know USA Hockey does is very extensive training with coaches, whether it's age-specific modules. We're now into, you know, how to treat children, abuse and things of that nature, how to look out for it. But one of the things that I noticed is the lack of education. We always have the parents at the beginning of the year. We'll have a parent meeting. We'll have the organization have the children or the parents sign a, you know, kind of a waiver saying, hey, we understand that this behavior is not going to be tolerated. But what I really think is lacking, and I'm not sure the USTA really does much on this, is, you know, extensive parent training like the coaches, so they understand the game, so they understand the mental aspects of the game, and what the children are going through, and how sports to be played. You know, I know, but you know, my you know, venue that I coach in, it's very difficult when you have a parent who is you know, hell bent on their child becoming a professional athlete, and that the rules don't apply to them.
Sure.
So I'm wondering, you know, what is the USTA doing on that? Because that's really, you know, the child tends to, the younger children tend to reflect kind of the parents' views, because a lot of parents, as we all know, especially in a one-on-one sport like tennis, the parents are tend to live a little bit vicariously through them. Go through the ups and downs, and as you were talking about, you know, tend to express their emotions out loud to everybody else, whether it's good or bad.
Well, all I can say to you is if USTA were doing enough in that arena, Parenting Aces would not exist. And it's true. And honestly, the reason for the creation of Parenting Aces in the first place was my frustration at not having access to the information I needed as a parent. And so, I mean, that's why, to me, the fact that USTA reached out and hired Larry in this position is such a huge step, a huge positive step. And, you know, I feel like I'm really lucky that I know how to get in touch with Larry. I know his email. Yep. I know his phone number. I know how to tweet him. And, you know, I feel like he's one of the people at USTA that I can straight up say, y'all aren't doing enough. You'll need to do this and this and this, like I said a few minutes ago. You know, it's all well and good to do these presentations at the big national events or at the regional training centers, but pretty much it's too late at that point. They need to be reaching these families at the entry level, and that means getting at the local tournaments and providing the information locally through, I mean, USTA's structure should provide easy access because there are so many sections, and each section has district or regional or state offices. I mean, to me, there's no excuse. And
right.
So, Larry, I love your devotion to that.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you, just the USA Hockey model, you know, we can't coach unless we complete certain live courses, online courses, and it's ongoing. I mean, it never stops. My problem with that is that there needs to be some stripped down version for parents that they should be able to complete, or they can't, you know, show up to hockey games or matches or whatever sport it is. I mean, it really comes down to, I mean, some of the comments that, you know, you hear, I mean, one of the jokes we always have in coaching is, why do you coach? Well, that's so I don't have to sit with the parents. And
that's a sad truth.
Yeah, you know, you sit there. I mean, I sat and watched a game after my son's game, just another team a year older, and just sitting with the parents, I mean, it's excruciating. And it's really, it's their lack of knowledge about the game. I mean, I'll give you a prime example in hockey, which is, you know, you have positions, and you have forwards and defensemen and goalies. And, you know, parents to this day, and hockey's been around my region for, you know, close to 100 years now, and they still say, my son plays offense or my son plays defense. And the defense always has a negative connotation to it, like they're not going to get goals. And meanwhile, in hockey, you have positions you play. Everybody plays offense and defense. Yet these parents have no idea really what they're looking at, and they get very upset, you know, because they don't understand the rules of the game. They don't understand, you know, how the game is being played. And a lot of that, again, gets pushed onto the coach. But if the national governing bodies would hit them at the grassroots when they come in and show them, hey, this is how the game is played. These are the rules of the game. These are some of the things that go on. But you need to understand this, and you need to understand the conduct that we expect, and you really need to be educated on that. And if you're not going to get educated on it, go ahead. Sorry, Larry.
No, I was just going to say, let me jump in. And I think, you know, being new to the USTA but having worked with them for a while, you know, there's some things, you know, like the 10 and under tennis and some different things that they're beginning to implement, but we really see the effect of those in 10 years. You implement something, you won't see the results of those efforts for a long time. I think I agree with both of you that the education has to occur early on and hit the parents up. How best to do that so that we're using our money wisely and getting to people is important, and we need to be creative. And still the messenger often is going to be the coach. But what I will say also is that one educational session is not going to cut it. It creates awareness, maybe creates some motivation. Greg, you know this. It just creates a window to open up to the idea that, hey, maybe this is a better way to do things. And then there's got to be that constant accountability, a communication at the local level of doing things the right way. So while, yes, USTA can provide resources and education and really create a model of, you know, and we're trying to do that, of what we expect, you know, doing that with the 10 and under and different programming, it's always going to come back as well on that local person, that coach, that director of tennis, to really be the point person to make that happen. So to me, the responsibility is on, it's on me, it's on us at USTA, and it's on really the coaches. It's on everybody. It's on the parents. We all have a role in this, and we all have to step up and make sure that we're doing what we can to make sure that the kids are playing in a safe and fun learning environment. And, you know, there's steps to take, and I think that they're going to happen. They may not happen tomorrow, but they're going to happen in some way, some fashion.
Right. My point is that at the root of it, you know, you have, and I grew up playing competitive tennis in the USTA, and you have some, you know, it's even, you don't even have a group setting. I mean, you'll have a match out on an outer court somewhere. It'll be out in court 34. It's the two kids, parents, and next thing you know, you hear yelling, screaming, and you know, an eruption out there. And you know, the only recourse that the governing bodies or the local group, the local sanctioning groups have, is to basically ban people. And as mentioned before, you could nip it in the bud by holding the parents accountable for being educated as well as the coaches. I mean, we know the coaches, for the most part, they come from quality programs and quality tennis facilities. I mean, I have a nephew who's a tennis pro, a teaching pro and a coach, and he has a teaching background. But, you know, you don't know who you're getting. So if you have the parents educated and held accountable as well, and, you know, I think that will it's not going to get rid of everybody. I mean, you're going to have your extreme cases like, you know, you had in the HBO special, but I think you're the better educated parent who's held accountable just like the child and the coach, then you have the triad. And I think the one piece that's not, missing from that is the parent education and the accountability of the parent, especially with the younger children. As you mentioned, you know, when they get to 16, 17, 18, then you really have to let go, and you really kind of take that back seat. But, you know, when they're developing, I mean, you're really, I've seen everything. I mean, in ice hockey, it's a physical game. I mean, God forbid, Bobby hits Johnny in a contact sport and everybody's yelling and screaming. But
Greg, I'm going to cut you off because we're at the end of our hour, and so I want to sum up the show. And as I mentioned to Larry before we went on the air, I actually have a tennis match to get to myself, so I'm being a little selfish here today. But I really appreciate you calling in, and Larry, I for one will be following very closely the developments that you're able to make at USTA in helping us parents become better educated and take more responsibility and be held more accountable for our behavior and the behavior of our children. And anything I can do, you know, via Parenting ACES to help in that effort, you know I'm 100% behind it. So I hope you'll keep me in the loop. And I want to thank you, Larry, for being on the show. Greg, thank you for calling in. Dewey, also, if you're still listening, thanks for calling in. And to the rest of you, have a great week. And we've got another fantastic show coming up next Monday. But the podcast for this one will be online later today. So be sure to check parentingaces.com/radio show. Thanks, all. Have a happy Monday.